Before we start, this episode discusses domestic violence and child abuse. If you or someone you know needs help, call the Utah Domestic Violence Link Line at 1-800-897-LINK or text START to 88788.
Utah lawmakers cover a lot of ground in 45 days, and some of the bills on the table get there because of tragedy.
Last year, the legislature passed a bill dealing with domestic violence reporting and how law enforcement handles those cases. That came to be, in part, because of a personal experience Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson and her family had.
Henderson's cousin, Mandy, was a victim of domestic violence. She was murdered by her ex-husband at a bus stop. But there were warning signs well before that.
We spoke with Henderson about the law two seasons ago. We'll link that episode in the show notes.
This session, there are several bills that also deal with abuse. I'm Sage Miller.
And I'm Sean Higgins. This week on State Street, we're discussing two of those bills aimed at protecting Utah children. One has been coined Ohm's Law in response to another personal story.
The other is a bill that has been introduced in the legislature before, but never made it across the finish line. It deals with religious clergy reporting child abuse.
On Mother's Day weekend 2023, 16-year-old Ohm Moses Gandhi was spending court-ordered, unsupervised family time with his father. His father shot and killed Ohm, then took his own life in a murder-suicide.
At the time, Ohm's parents were locked in a bitter custody battle. Court records show years of disputes between the two since Ohm's mom, Leah Moses, first filed for divorce in 2009. Another cruel twist in this story is that Moses had already dedicated most of her professional and personal life to domestic violence and abuse advocacy work. She's a board member of the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition and has been involved in efforts to reform family court law, even before her son's death.
Now, the changes Moses has been pushing for are in front of the Utah legislature. She told me what that means to her after the bill's first committee hearing on February 8th.
I think I really feel peaceful. This is something I've been working towards for a long time. It hasn't been in the last 9 months. It's really, truly been Ohm's whole life. So I think after 17 years, this is in some ways, it's an interesting, unexpected closure for me. And we're not done yet, but at least a first step.
To cut to the heart of it, family court is very sticky. Divorce is messy, especially when there are children involved.
What this bill is trying to do is eliminate some of the gray areas in the process. It's centered around when there are allegations of child abuse. I talked to Republican bill sponsor Representative Paul Cutler, and here's how he put it.
This gives some extra checklist that says the court shall consider evidence of domestic violence or abuse. They shall consider whether somebody is intentionally exposing kids to pornography. They shall consider, they must consider the danger to the children. And gives just a checklist of other things to make sure, go back and check. Is there a history of domestic violence or violence in the family that we need to consider as part of keeping children safe?
To clarify, word choice is important in legal documents. There's a big difference between the words may and shall. So instead of the family courts maybe considering allegations of abuse, they have to. Priority number one under this bill is the safety of the child.
That isn't always the case right now.
Sean, when we were researching this episode, I was really surprised that it wasn't already the top priority in family court.
Like you said, family court is messy. There can be other things the court says are more important. For example, it could value reuniting a child with an estranged parent over claims of abuse. Erin Jemison is the director of public policy at the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition. She explained it to me like this.
Right now, the best interest of the child is very clear in terms of what courts need to consider, but there's a list of required considerations for judges, and there's a list of considerations that they may include when they're deliberating on these cases. And this bill moves evidence. It has to be evidence. It's not just someone's word, but evidence of family violence, domestic violence in that list of factors that a court has to consider. And so it really puts more weight on that and allows victims' voices to be heard in a way that isn't just assuming that it's just another part of a contentious custody battle, that it actually gets heard.
There's an emphasis on evidence, because it can be hard to know who's telling the truth when two people really don't like each other.
Which leads us to another change in this bill, expert testimony.
Currently, the definition of expert in child custody proceedings is quite loose. Cutler says this bill aims to tighten those screws.
You can't pretend to be a child abuse expert if you have no experience working with victims of child abuse and no training in this area. If you want to go to the court and say, I'm an expert in child abuse and domestic violence, then you should have experience and credentials in that area.
That seems pretty reasonable.
There are two other big pillars to this law. One puts more guidance and limitations around court-ordered reunification between parents and children. The other increases training for people who work in family courts. Think judges and court-appointed custody evaluators. It would equip them to recognize signs of physical and psychological abuse and domestic violence.
It's worth highlighting one more time that Leah Moses, Ohm's mom, knows the ins and outs of the Utah family court system. And she still lost a child.
No piece of paper and no statute is going to stop an abuser. I mean, that's just the reality of things. But I truly believe that if it had been in place and if it had been used and really put into motion, then he would be here with us today. I think he'd be able to testify, actually. If it had been, maybe it would have had to be someone else's child, but, you know, it was my child.
You're listening to State Street. We'll be right back to hear more about another law that aims to protect victims of abuse.
Hi, I'm Caroline Ballard, State Street's executive producer. We know that our show's listeners are smart and curious, and we want to harness that power. Do you have a question that's been keeping you up at night about how the legislature works? We're also interested in what issues are most important to you this session. Let us know at kuber.org/statestreet. We may tackle your question in future reporting.
Support for State Street comes from the Hinckley Report on PBS Utah. I'm Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. The Hinckley Report is Utah's weekly political roundup, bringing together Utah's top journalists, political thinkers, and lawmakers to help you understand how politics impacts your life. Listen to the Hinckley Report wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to State Street. I'm Sage Miller.
And I'm Sean Higgins. So we've talked about Ohm's Law, which reforms how family court operates if a parent has been accused of child abuse.
Now, another lawmaker, Republican Representative Anthony Lubbe, is trying his hand at a bill that the legislature hasn't had much of an appetite for in previous sessions. It deals with religious clergy, like a Catholic priest or a bishop in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, reporting known or suspected child abuse. And it would give them a path to report that abuse to law enforcement.
Over the last year, the Associated Press has been investigating reports that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has an internal method for dealing with allegations of child abuse. That's possible because in some states, clergy have special protections because of the sacred nature of confession. And Utah is one of those states. Basically, you can tell a priest or an LDS bishop all kinds of stuff as part of repenting. Even illegal stuff, and they don't have to report you to police because of spiritual vows they've taken.
Democrat Angela Romero has tried running similar bills in the past. They've all failed.
But this bill has one big change from what's been seen before. It doesn't make clergy mandatory reporters. It gives them the option to report, and they would get legal protections in return. Bill sponsor Anthony Lubbe says it works like this.
This bill allows a member of the clergy who reasonably believes that a child is a subject of ongoing abuse or neglect, to report the information even if the perpetrator was previously or has previously made a confession to the clergy member. It acknowledges that the duty to protect the child may outweigh the confidentiality traditionally associated with confessions. By allowing reporting in such circumstances, we aim to create a safer environment for our children, free from the shadows of abuse and neglect.
Another difference between Loubet's bill and previous versions Romero ran is the lack of resistance from religious institutions. The LDS Church and the Catholic Church say they do not oppose the bill as it's written.
To understand more, we spoke with a current LDS bishop. Jared Zemp serves in his downtown Salt Lake City ward. Similar to a priest, he hears a lot of heavy topics from his congregation, and he keeps that sensitive information confidential.
Because bishops are volunteers, they may not have extensive professional background in counseling. Though new bishops are required to complete training on protecting children within 1 month of being called to service.
We reached out to Latter-day Saint scholar Matthew Bowman, who says besides that training, some states may require additional measures. That's if the state they're in has laws on the books pertaining to religious leaders and how they handle abuse.
And Zemp told me he and other bishops have access to more resources.
It's important to note that we spoke with Zemp on a personal basis. His insight is his own. He's not speaking on behalf of the church.
I started by asking Zemp about his responsibilities as a bishop.
Usually means that on Sundays I come in at about 7:30 a.m. and then we have, you know, bishopric meeting, and then we have ward council or welfare meeting, and then we have our sacrament meeting and our Sunday school meeting. Then it's usually individual or family counseling. And sometimes that's just, hey, we're in a tight spot financially. Can you help us see our way through? Other times it's hey, I'm having trouble in my marriage, or I'm struggling with addiction, or all the above, right? Or sometimes it's stuff like the issue we're talking about today, where people are saying, I'm having memories. I'm remembering being abused, and I don't know who my abuser is, or I do know who my abuser is, or I'm currently being abused. And, in that moment, you realize my whole life has kind of prepared me to be sympathetic and have empathy in this moment. But you also realize how no amount of training could actually prepare you to look in the face of somebody who's looking to you as though you've got the answers for something that's just so painful and so inexcusable. And those feel like sacred moments, you know, like a real sacred trust.
This is a very familiar process to folks who have, you know, grown up in the church or converted to the church or studied the church. But what should non-religious people know about this process of coming and confiding in your bishop, or even just the repentance process?
Oh, that's a big question.
That's what I'm here for.
That's right. I think that there's several elements to that whole process. The repentance process is fundamentally about getting on your knees and praying to feel clean again and trying to understand what your responsibility is to be forgiven. And a lot of that work is done, I think, on an individual basis with God. And in some cases, they feel like, hey, I need extra help. That's cases like addiction. Where they feel like they aren't in control and they could use some extra support. It's cases like, you know, serious stuff like, you know, hey, I'm married and I've been sleeping around. Usually cases that involve other people, where it's not just somebody on their own. Those are the kind of cases where they'll usually come and talk to their bishop and say, hey, how do I repent of this? This is bigger than me. This is really serious. The biggest thing that I feel in those circumstances is just an overwhelming sense of love, that it's not about punishment. It's a lot more about empowerment. What are the next steps to strengthen you so that you can turn into the kind of person you want to be?
some of those topics that are brought to you in this position of ecclesiastical leadership can be very heavy and I guess sometimes absolutely illegal. What do you think of this law of bishops or priests or any kind of clergy having the opportunity to report abuse to law enforcement if they see fit?
Oh, I've wrestled with this so much. I really have. There's two sides to this issue. Clearly, when a child is being abused, you want to do everything you can to stop the abuse. At the same time, in my actual experience, I've found that very few of these abuse cases are as cut and dried as that. You know, it's very rare that when they come in, they say, you know, this is ongoing abuse. It's happening now. This is the perpetrator. This is when and how it happens. And all you got to do is call the police and it stops. Oftentimes, there are many mitigating circumstances. Many times, there's homelessness involved, mental illness involved, drug addiction involved, where you're not sure that reporting would actually lead to the safety of the children, where you're worried that reporting would actually lead to the abuser absconding with the child. And so it never boils, in my experience, it's never boiled down to a clear-cut, yes, I should just call the police. And oftentimes when it is reported, it's been reported as something that people suspect but don't have direct knowledge of. Sometimes it's reported as, I remember being abused and I can't remember the face of my abuser, remembering abuse that's happened in the past. And so I find that it's difficult to, I wish that we could pass legislature that would put a Band-Aid on this. But I don't think it's that simple.
If law enforcement can't back up the tip with any evidence, it's possible that this abuse could still go unchecked. So I guess how much of an impact do you think this law would even end up having, just giving the option?
It hasn't been my experience that the abuser comes in and confesses. It has been my experience that people who are abused come in and seek help, or people who suspect abuse come in and seek for guidance on how to report. And I think this makes a lot of sense. This policy makes a lot of sense when there is clear-cut either confession from a perpetrator or somebody who has firsthand knowledge saying, I know about this and this is going on. Then I would feel like, as a bishop, I had the protection of the state to make that report without feeling, at least legally, like I was putting myself and my family at risk. Even just the theoretical aspect of that actually gives me some comfort. Because then I feel like I'm not on my own trying to make this weighty decision of, do I report to protect the child and know that my family is at risk, you know, of a serious civil suit?
So you like the option on the table?
I love the option on the table, but it still makes it a difficult decision to employ.
So I guess it would be a different story if you became a mandatory reporter.
In some ways, I mean, I don't mean to make light of the situation, but in some ways it kind of comes down to this game theory. Will a perpetrator ever confess to me if they know that I have to mandatorily report? I think that I don't get those confessions at that point.
Do you have any concerns with the law?
My concerns are mostly philosophical. You know, philosophically, we need people to have the protection of clergy. All the way back to the earliest stages of our government, we've said that that protection exists and is sacrosanct. And so philosophically, I think there are real reasons to raise red flags. And that's a much larger question. It's like asking an attorney, would you defend somebody you knew was guilty? And they say yes, because even the guilty deserve the best defense. Because philosophically, that's the way it has to be in order for things to work. And I think that clergy, the privilege of clergy, falls under that sort of high-level argument. But as a bishop, that's not my job, right? My job as a bishop is fundamentally to my congregation. And it's a real boots on the ground, rubber hits the road. You know, it's the text message at 11 o'clock at night. Bishop, I just want to smoke so bad right now. You know, please, can you help me? You know, and then you quietly excuse yourself and you go to the bathroom and you have a whispered conversation. You can do it. You've got this, you know. I mean, that's what being a bishop is. And so, you know, from that perspective, from the boots on the ground, from sitting on the other side of the desk in that moment when you find out this child is not safe, those big philosophical questions go out the window and you say, what do I got to do to protect this child right now?
Do you think this law will change how you approach speaking one-on-one with any members of your congregation?
No, but I can tell you what did fundamentally change things for me. When I was sitting on the high council, and there was a man who was a child sex offender, and he'd been out of the church for about 20 years, and he came back. And it was a long, hard road back. And the fact that he offended years and years, decades earlier, was still offensive to everybody in the room. And then he sits down and he tells his story. And he tells what he's gone through in order to try and come back and to try and make things right with God after such a horrible offense. And not just one, but over a long period of time. And after years and years and years and years in prison. And you say, how is it possible that this guy can ever be forgiven in this life? And then he begins to tell you about the horrible abuse that he suffered that turned him into who he was. Not as an excuse, but in many cases, things he didn't even know about himself until he got to prison and actually started meeting with a therapist. And you start realizing that these issues are so much more complex, and that there is room for forgiveness for even the most vile of sinners. And there are people like that that we just want to write off. It would have been so much easier for the 15 guys in that room to just say, we're done with you. Let God deal with you later. But I can tell you that it was such a beautiful experience sitting in that room and talking to that man and feeling the redemptive love that just filled the room as he talked about how sorry he was and everything he'd done to try and make it right, and realizing that that was never going to be enough, but that it was only through the atonement and only through seeking forgiveness and only through something much bigger than himself that he could ever be forgiven for something so horrible. That experience fundamentally changed my perspective. That when you think of even the vilest of sinners being able to be forgiven, then you come to respect the idea of a perpetrator having the privilege of clergy as something that can be redemptive instead of just something that stands in the way of giving a child protection. I think we should do everything we possibly can to protect children, you know, including having the option to report. But I also think that we need to be very careful as we come up against this idea that what are the limits in the protection of clergy?
That was Jared Zemp, a bishop with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We've covered two bills here. They both have wide bipartisan support, but there have been some hiccups in the process.
Something did happen with Ohm's Law. The House debated the bill on February 16th, and they motioned to circle it.
Essentially, that means lawmakers sent the bill back to iron out a few kinks before there's another vote to potentially move things forward. We heard there are concerns from family law lawyers, and some lawmakers wanted to make extra sure that all those mays and shalls we talked about earlier were in the right places.
This is the important part. This doesn't mean the bill failed. It just means it needs a little bit more work. But the clergy bill passed unanimously through the House on the same day. Not a single no vote in sight.
That bill now heads to the Senate, where the process starts over again.
Although the House vote was unanimous, that doesn't mean it's guaranteed smooth sailing. Many things can happen before it lands on Governor Spencer Cox's desk.
Why these two bills are having a moment right now may have to do with their similarities. They're both run by Republicans. Remember, Utah is a Republican supermajority legislature, and they're both centered around the safety of children. That's a unifying issue for many Utah leaders.
Like we mentioned, similar bills have come up in the past and haven't gone anywhere. That includes a version of the clergy bill run by House Minority Leader Angela Romero. She doesn't think this bill goes far enough, but is a step in the right direction, and she'll take it.
Religious leaders need to be mandatory reporters because I think it's in the best interest of our community, and I really feel like it's our duty as elected officials to protect innocent children. It's our duty, and we talk about that all the time, and we talk about families, and we talk about the Utah way. And so for me, how do we move forward? Because I know people are conflicted because of their spirituality, but for me, spirituality is much deeper than the institution that people worship. And for me, what's more important is protecting another child from being a victim of child sex abuse or abuse in general, and in some cases, getting that individual the help they need.
These bills deal with complex situations.
Whether it's child custody or confessions of abuse, those are some murky waters to navigate for anyone charged with making decisions.
And like Leah Moses said, no piece of legislation is going to stop an abuser. But it could help give victims and witnesses more opportunities to shine a light on what is happening. That does it for this week of State Street. I'm Sean Higgins.
And I'm Sage Miller. Jim Hill, Eleanor Gomberg, and Raquel Davis make up the digital team.
David Childs and KUER News Director Elaine Clark helped edit this episode. Caroline Ballard is our executive producer.
There's more on our website, including links to relevant reporting, a sign-up link for our newsletter, and a feedback form.
And a final reminder, if you or someone you know is in crisis, you can always find help at the Utah Domestic Violence Link Line at 1-800-897-LINK or text the word START to 88788.
And we'll see you next week.
From KUER.